sounds like you, contact me, Marlo Blue, at pdkpft@gmail.com or leave a message at 713-526-4000 extension 1003. Hey, KPFT is looking for you.
Hi, I'm Mel.
And I'm Ro.
We're from Shame on Me.
And you're listening to KPFT Houston.
For you? I'm crying looking for you.
Hey, you're listening to KPFT Houston. This is Pacifica Radio KPFT in Houston, 90.1 FM, KPFT.org. 89.5 in Galveston and 91.9 FM, Huntsville, Texas. Beautiful Huntsville, and I'm Jacqueline Batiste. I'm of the Alabama and Coushatta Nations of East Texas. And people of Earth, it is Indigenous radio news, views, and music sometimes, and the latest information and just sharing of Indigenous knowledge as well. Honoring those that have gone before and future generations yet to come.
This country imports one half of the oil we consume, 8 million barrels a day. We spend $57 million to import oil. ANWR has to be part of that policy, because if it isn't, this nation does not have an energy policy.
If they're going to do it up there, why don't they be honest and say everything's open, it's so important to the country, we're starting to drill Yellowstone tomorrow.
You don't know what wilderness is. Except some yuppies come in here and say, oh, wouldn't it be great if we could set it aside for wilderness? Now, that's who you're talking about setting aside Alaska for, the very, very wealthy of the United States.
It seems, Mr. Chairman, that what you would like is a risk-free environment, either from nature or from man, and you're never going to achieve that. Man probably can control the environment a little better than nature apparently does.
It is unfortunate that we're still having this discussion about whether to develop the 1002 area in Alaska.
I know what I'm talking about. The Arctic plain is really nothing. You say it's not the heart. It is not the heart. It is not the heart. But the reality is this area should be drilled. I've been fighting this battle for 39 years.
We have we've got a battle in front of us. The fight is on, and we are not backing down.
You environmentalists always portray this ANWR out there as beautiful as Colorado with the mountains and everything and the vistas and this and that. But in actuality, what you are talking about is tundra, known in most parlance as wasteland. There's nothing out there. It's a virtual plain. As far as the eye can see, there's nothing out there.
We are raised to protect the area. To us, it's not work, it's livelihood. It's, you know, who we are, it's our life. And like some people would call it activism, but we're just trying to protect our way of life. This is a People magazine from 1989, and this is our traditional chief. Alaska's Gwich'in Indians have lived undisturbed for 10,000 years. Now America's energy needs threaten the tribe's survival. I went to a summit and they were all like, the Gwich'in been standing up to one of the biggest governments in the world for 28 years and there's 8,000 of us. Honestly, I'm not the same person I was when I started. The Western world really took a huge impact on a lot of us and I wasted a lot of time. And it's time for me to do my part. That's the coastal plain. That's the sacred area to us. That's where we have always been told to protect by our elders.
And what are the red dots to the left?
These are where they're drilling.
I don't know if people really understand the history of the Alaska Native people with our government. I didn't speak Gwich'in growing up because my... my mother was hit for speaking it, and she didn't think that it meant much. That generation was told to be ashamed of everything that makes us who we are, of our beliefs, of our language, of the way we eat and what we eat.
United Nationwide, Native Sat side by side. Gotta stop the drilling, save the caribou. That's all about.
I lost my brother to suicide in 2006, February 7th. So then I started, like, I drank every single day. I don't know, I just went down the wrong path. From there, I just kind of just lost myself, and I wasn't always a good mom. And I just feel like I'm doing this also for them in a big, huge way, and I just feel like I gained their respect back.
My mother and my grandparents, you know, despite having gone through everything that they went through, they did instill in myself and my brothers such a strong sense of be proud of who you are and who we are, our beautiful people. The Gwich'in gathering is that time that we as a Gwich'in nation get to unite and we get to address the issues that we're facing and to know that it's okay, you're going to fall down, but we're going to be here to help you stand back up.
Creator, thank you for this beautiful, blessed day. Thank you for all the love and beauty in our lives. I just ask that you bless our travels and all of our relatives that are traveling by boat and by air, and that you bring a sense of peace and calm to us as we travel. We look forward to the smiles and the laughter and the sense of peace of celebrating this life, of celebrating our connection and our relationship to the land and ancestors. And we just ask that you alleviate any anxiousness or nervousness that we might have to be present in the moment and to truly enjoy this experience of life.
You're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM. To mention that you just heard the voices, several voices from a piece from Patagonia, and it can be found, it's just a portion of a much larger piece about the National Arctic Wildlife Refuge and the Gwich'in Nation, the coastal plain there, and of the Gwich'in Nation, the sacred place where life begins, And that's just a portion of much larger piece that you can find on YouTube, Patagonia film. And mentioning that, today is March 5th, yes, and on January 14th, conservation groups filed an amended and supplemented complaint in the U.S. District Court, District of Alaska, challenging the Department of Interior's push to the wildlife refuge to oil and gas leasing. The filing reviews and updates a 2020 lawsuit adding new claims challenging the Interior's October 2025 decision to again open the coastal plain to leasing. It also seeks to set aside the unlawful leases held by the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, a state-sponsored corporation, which the Interior originally issued in 2021 and then reinstated in October. So the amended complaint alleges violations of the National Environmental Policy Act, the Endangered Species Act, the National Wildlife Refuge System Administration Act. And so this is brought together by many groups, the NRDC, the Earth Justice Co-counsels, and also the Center for Biological Diversity and Friends of Earth. The Gwich'in have been fighting and succeeding for decades in protecting the calving grounds of the porcupine caribou herd. And Kristen Moreland is their executive director. She says that today we continue to fight, and we are grateful to our allies that stand with us. It is inconceivable that this administration is advancing an Arctic refuge leasing plan, which is opposed by a majority of Americans and would violate the rights of Alaska Native people, and blatantly contains multiple legal deficiencies. This is yet another attempt by the administration to prioritize profits over people, and we say enough is enough. And that's actually a statement on behalf and by the Gwich'in Steering Committee and Kristen Moreland, who is their executive director. And having said that, today being March 5th, and this from the Gwich'in, they just released this. Gwich'in Nation is responding to the Trump administration announcing first step in oil and gas lease sale of the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge. And the Bureau of Land Management announced a call for nominations for a lease state sale on the coastal plain. And this is the first step in the process of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. This is the first step of leasing the coastal plain, the sacred area of the Gwich'in. And the Gwich'in Nation has, as mentioned, for decades, have opposed this, has stopped this, went through a really strong battle during the W. Bush administration, and won. They managed to hang on into it. And so this announcement comes on the heels of two consecutive failed Arctic refuge lease sales. And so what they want to say, and again with their executive director, is talking about wants, and you can find out more information about it from the Gwich'in Steering Committee's website, the Gwich'in Nation. And what they want you to know is actually that tonight, right now, they're in the this is the time when the last day actually for anybody in the United States to let what they think about this be known, and today is the time for that if people are interested. If you need to know more information, you want to learn more about it, of course, you can go to the Gwitchin website, and that's G-W-I-T-H-T-C-H-N. So, again, that's what's going on. Tonight is the last evening or night that anyone can have a say, actually. This is their deadline. So there's that. Again, I want to mention that you're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT, 90.1 FM, kpft.org, and also a really deep gratitude for all the people that supported KPFT, supported People of Earth during this fun drive. I wanted to mention many of you. I don't have your names right in front of me, and of course, we only mention first names here, but we see you, and we're so grateful that many people came up to the plate and showed their support for this program, People of Earth and Voices, Indigenous People, and also for KPFT in general, just the whole KPFT, trying to hang in there and be a some kind of, you know, keep a sail, all the things that are going on here on this station, and bringing you some of the news and information that you're not hearing in other places, and sometimes you are hearing in other places, but we're beyond the sound bites. That's what we do, and so there's that. So I want to honor Midnight Oil right now and play some music. Hey there, you're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM. Of course, that was Diesel and Dust. Anyway, that was Midnight Oil, who lost their founding member recently. I wanted to mention also today, I mentioned about the this being the mid-March 5th, by midnight is the last chance for, what I didn't say was the environmental impact statement. So that's what's going on, that's what they're taking, and the government is taking that now. So there's that. And I want to mention that, I guess we are in Women's History Month, but of course here in at People of Earth, it's Women's Month all the time, or day. We are always celebrating Indigenous women here, and sharing so many, the women, the center of so much that's going on in the Indigenous world. So I want to go back to somebody who has walked on, but as she walked on January 1st, 2021, 5 years ago, and I'm grateful, honored to have gotten to have met her and spent some time with her various times. She's a Shoshone Indigenous person, Carrie Dan, Indigenous activist, dedicated her life to preserving the Western Shoshone treaty rights and to opposing the federal government's confiscation of the family's cattle. She clashed with the government over several mining projects and the shipment of nuclear waste to southern Nevada, to their homelands. And in 1933, Carrie Dan she was the sixth of seven, and she grew up in Biowa, on the ranch, a Shoshone ranch, granted to her father by the federal government. Instead of creating a reservation, the government granted an allotment of 160 acres of land for farming and cattle grazing to certain Shoshone men in Crescent Valley. So this land became the subject of Carrie and her older sister, Mary Dan, disputes with the federal government. The Dan sisters, in 1970s, clashes became regular between Mary and Carrie with the federal government's Bureau of Land Management, the BLM. The Dans quit paying for government grazing for their cattle on their allotment, pursuant of the Treaty of 1863, signed in the Ruby Valley, the Treaty of Ruby Valley, Nevada. And the sisters claimed the Shoshone tribe legally owned the land, not the federal government. Therefore, they were not required to pay grazing fees. In 1974, the BLM sued them, arguing their cattle were trespassing on federal land without the family obtaining a permit and paying the fees. So the sisters argued that their Aboriginal title to the land precluded the government from requiring them to obtain these permits. They refused all the years. And so there's that for now. And let's hear the voice of Carrie Dan at this time.
I lived the old way, and it was fun days for me growing up.
Aloha, vahine hawaii vau,
maha hawaii. Tasana hohino puhu.
Because, we're talking for the future generations.
I'm Conroy Chino, introducing you to Living Voices, profiles of Native Americans and Native Hawaiians today. Carrie Dan, with her sister Mary, has spearheaded the fight to preserve Western Shoshone lands in Nevada. Her life has been dedicated to putting the issues of Native sovereignty and guardianship of the land in the international spotlight.
I am Carrie Dan, and I am a traditional Western Shoshone brought up in a traditional manner. I am a environmental activist now, and I always started out as a land right activist. So I'm really an activist, I guess. How do I feel? You know, I felt that up to the 1970s, before they brought this lawsuit against us, we really lived in freedom. I guess you can go back to our grazing issue. We've always been out there. They claim we're overgrazing, but it's a term that they use so that environmentalists and other types of people would look at us as the bad guys, but we're not bad. The local county government knew we were out there. I suppose the state of Nevada knew we were out there. BLM knew we were out there. And we were out there without their permission. We had no reason to seek their permission because, in reality, it's Western Shoshone land. In 1974, they brought this lawsuit against me and Mary. And during that time, we certainly went through all kinds of hurdles from district court to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, eventually ending up in the Supreme Court of the United States. Our grandmother especially and my aunt and my mom were pretty vocal as far as what Western Shoshone rights were. And we grew up with the idea that, with the knowledge, not idea, but with the knowledge, it was Western Shoshone lands. We don't individually hold land rights. We're the caretakers. That's how we find ourselves, as caretakers of the land. Not only of little pieces and plots here and there. As a nation, we're caretakers of the whole thing. And we're supposed to see that that land will be in good shape for the next seven generations to come. We'll be able to have life on it, whether it's Shoshone life, white people's children's life, or there's your bird life, there's your animal life, all life. That is part of our duty, is to see that that land is in good shape to take care of the future generations to come. You've got to let the people know the environmental damage that's being done by nuclear testing, by possibility of a nuclear waste spill, and the possibility of where it's being buried down there at Yucca Mountain. There's not enough people out there that's talking about these things. We're not going to give up the sacredness. We're not going to give up trying to take care of the water or the clean air. We're going to do this as long as we can breathe, because we're talking for the future generations. I'm getting too damn old to work like I used to anymore. After when you get, you know, beyond certain age, you know, your mind says to do it, but your body says, no way. I guess I should be very proud of being a role model to Indigenous people. I don't think I'm a role model, but, you know, if they want me to be a role model, I'll be the best role model that I can possibly be.
This interview with Carrie Dan was conducted by William Albright. Living Voices is a project of the Smithsonian Institution, National Museum of the American Indian.
You're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM. And so in 1997, the Dan sisters unsuccessfully protested the expansion of Barrick Gold Corporation mining project near Cortez Hills. Additionally, Carrie Dan fiercely opposed the nuclear waste site, the shipping, to Yucca Mountain and fought for relief for tribal residents affected by the nuclear testing site. And in 2011, she was arrested in anti-nuclear protesting at the Nevada test site north of Las Vegas, and she was arrested along with actor Martin Sheen and many, many others. So there's that. Carrie Dan walked on 5 years ago, and she's at the age of 87. You're listening to People of Earth. Always grateful and honored to be here with you. think I should mention a few things about KPFT. KPFT.org. You can go over there and see all kinds of things that are going on with your radio station. I hope you make us your radio station. But coming up in April, and I know these tickets are going to go really fast, and they do. So there's another blues cruise. They said it was the second. I guess I'm not counting right. I thought it was the third, but they said it's the second here. So April 18, 1 to 4, and it's a party boat, party boat, three-hour cruise. And they leave from the Kima Boardwalk, and DJ Nuri Nuri of Blues Brunch. And he'll be serving the blues to all the passengers. So go over there, get your blues on. And again, you can find out all about that at kpft.org. And then also something else KPFT is doing. This is about the 56th birthday party for KPFT. It's the craw. Anyway, crawfish boil and jamboree, March 29th. And that's from 1 to 5. Going to have music, crawfish, beverages, and fun. They promise fun. So, again, that's because of the 56th birthday anniversary of KPFT. So, again, everything you need to know. And that's over at 607 East Whitney. And that's Houston, right here in Houston. I guess that's pretty central Houston. So if you want to get your tickets or anything, you need to go to kpft.org. Or you can call KPFT business hour time and find out more information. Mention again about the activist, the indigenous activist that is doing time in a Russian prison. And she's Daria Egariva. She is Selkup indigenous, and she's an activist and human rights defender, and she's from Western Siberia. And she's advocated for indigenous rights in many international forums. She's been to the United Nations many times, and she's a very devoted global climate negotiator on behalf of indigenous peoples. And she's served as co-chair of the International Indigenous Peoples Forum on Climate Change, also representing communities affected by climate, indigenous peoples affected by climate and environmental policies. She's been very active, and this past December, Russian authorities raided her home, arrested her, charged her with alleged involvement in terrorist organizations, which she isn't, it's a claim widely condemned as fabricated. And human rights groups all over are coming out and taking up for her and say her prosecution is a retaliation for her peaceful advocacy and international work. And it warns that this is reflecting a broader crackdown on indigenous and civil society activists in Russia. So she is a wife, she's a mother, and right now she's in prison. And it's not looking very good for her at this time. It doesn't look good for her getting out anytime soon. I mean, this could be very serious for her to have many years taken from her there. So she has a website, and her name, Daria, E-G-E-R-E-V-A. And she also, they're asking for messages to her if you want to communicate. And they, the people taking care of her website, will translate the messages into Russian for you. So, again, that's about Daria Agareva, who is Selkup Indigenous. And there you go.
Gichinane tu mistae kitata mehin ni mama e kwa ni papa kya petu taski
to again say thank you to all the people that supported People of Earth. And yes, Daniel, Jim, Hannah, Damien, Larry, James, Brent, so many people. I hope I didn't leave anybody out. If I did, I'll make up for it another time. But we know you, we see you, and so grateful that you honor us in that way. Thank you. Thank you very, very much.
together. Moonlight fires are kindled, sending it back. We just make it go back. Beating hearts, come as one. This is Indian country. This is Indian country. Together we dance, all of First Nation. There's no chance we ever gonna give up.
Robbie Robertson there, Stump Dance. Yes, International Women's Day is coming. It's on the 8th. Always like to honor that. But so in lieu of all that and that, we're going to share this piece again, another piece about an Indigenous woman who has been active for a very long time, and so, Gutsy Cook, and we're going to go with that in just a few seconds here.
Introducing you to Living Voices, profiles of Native Americans and Native Hawaiians today. In her work as a midwife and teacher, Gutsy Cook has helped reestablish the importance of traditional Mohawk knowledge and practices.
My name is Gutsy Cook. I come from the Mohawk Nation at Akwesasne, and I'm a traditional Mohawk midwife. I should begin with my grandmother, my father's mother. Her name, Elizabeth Hearn Cook. Ganatdiles was her Mohawk name, and it means she leads the village. She delivered me at home in 1952 and delivered many of the babies in my generation and had 15 children of her own. And her mother was a midwife. I went to our longhouse for the first time when I was 15 years old, and I sat up all night at an Okiwe ceremony, which is a ceremony held in the fall or in the spring to remember those who are gone on and before us. One of the things that I saw at Okiwe was the women's dance. I guess you could call it a medicine dance for the women. It seemed as though everything was coming together before me in that one ceremony, and the work of women was something that I wanted to do. I wanted that for my life too. I decided to go to a community I had been to, the Pine Ridge Reservation of South Dakota, the Lakota people. And when I got there, I was just so impressed with their birth stories. And so I thought I could learn something from these people, because my own people seemed to have forgotten about birth. When I asked the elders there about birthing knowledge, they just would scratch their heads and say, "I think we forgot all of that." Later, of course, I would find that we didn't forget it. We just stopped doing it. Once you start doing it again, that's how the knowledge comes back. But the women learned midwifery from the corn. What a beautiful teaching. The corn itself has a gestation that recapitulates human gestation. "Return to the arms of Mother Corn," goes one Aztec saying that I happen to really love. And so part of my research in Ongwehuwe midwifery had to do with growing a field of corn. Every time someone would pull back a husk and expose this new ear, and people would respond to this corn as if they were looking at a new baby. When you bundle a baby, the description means they're putting the husk back on the corn. And so a lot of the language of taking care of our families at birth and our babies has to do with the language the women used when they took care of the cornfields. Not every woman can have her baby at home. I do extremely careful risk screening, and the indicators that I use are not just, again, her blood pressure and her complete blood count, what her hemoglobin level is. I want to know what's her state of mind and where is her spirit at. And so in the process of doing births and working professionally in human health research, I've been able to see what moves the medical world and what needs there are in our community life to restore birth to this ceremony that it truly is.
This interview with Gudgy Cook was conducted by Rich Brotman. Living Voices is a project of the Smithsonian Institution, National Museum of the American Indian.
You're listening to People of Earth. You're right here at KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org. And we'll hear just maybe one more piece from Living Earth about things that Indigenous women have been doing.
Conroy Chino introducing you to Living Voices, Profiles of Native Americans and Native Hawaiians Today. Artist Elle Frank did not connect with her tribal heritage until she was almost 30. Then she began a journey to discover the artifacts taken centuries before from her people, the Tongva Ahashimin of Southern California.
L. Frank, formerly known Gabrielino Juan Enyo, slave names, San Gabriel Mission, San Juan Capistrano Mission, Tongva Ahashimim. I'm an artist, and I'm a tribal scholar, and that wasn't through choice. That was in trying to hold on, retain, grasp at straws through archives, what's left of our history. So actually, I'm just a native nerd. When I was 29 years old, I had the occasion to meet my father, who was the California native side of my family. That's when it all clicked and came into place. I was ready to do this, to be the Indian that I always had been. And so I began to look at the basketry and to start to weave. And then I found out that we carved stone objects, bowls, effigies. So I began to investigate how to make those. And I made the first stone bowl by someone in our tribe in 200 years. The making of these new pieces is an incredible bridge to the past. When I go visit archives and I see the stone pieces, I understand how they're made. I understand the feelings of the maker. I found out that there were collections all over the world and that a 5,000-piece collection from my homeland was taken to France by Léon de Sessac in 1877. So I was bound and determined then to go to where the majority of these were and to look at them, to touch history, you know, to touch things that my ancestors had touched and felt and loved and put their lives into. So I get there, and I go the very first day to the collections room. And when I got there and was actually emotional, I was stunned. I was overwhelmed by the fact that here was a whole group of people's lives, a whole village sitting on shelves, and it all cried and spoke at once. It was too overwhelming, and I just had to cry. It was so all of these objects all became real live people to me. There were utilitarian objects, there were sacred objects, there were skulls, there were toys, there were stone pendants, there were a few baskets. All these things, just like they did to the natives, threw us all into one spot and expected everybody to live happily together, and all these objects weren't happy. I could feel that. It was just too much for me. I was absolutely unprepared for the weight of the collection. Museums are strange enough places, but to go so far from home and see your life and your grandmother's and your grandfather's lives, your people's lives, either on display or in dusty shelves where nobody cares about it, it's a hard thing to take. That's why many natives don't do that. These objects that we look at in museums, these objects, they belong to all of us. They tell our story. They're a history that can't be rewritten by the winners. Cham cha pa chama mai om chiqui squi cham. Cham cha pa chama mai om chiqui squi cham. Cham cha pa chama mai om chiqui squi cham. Cham cha pa chama mai om chiqui squi cham. Wamyapa, wamyapa. We want to get away, we want to run away. I love that. It's so sad.
This interview with L. Frank was conducted by Kat High. Living Voices is a project of the Smithsonian Institution, National Museum of the American Indian. Executive producers Kevin Lewis and Elizabeth Weatherford. Project coordinator Nan Rubin. Writers Peggy Berryhill and Ginger Miles, mixed at Mercer Street Sound. For more information, check out our website at www.si.edu/NMAI. For Living Voices, I'm Conroy Chino.
Okay, so there's that, Living Voices. And again, honoring some of the many things many different Indigenous women have done. And we're coming up to the end of the program here at People of Earth. I'm Jacqueline Batiste. Please stay tuned for the next program. And that is Sonic Reducer, and what a lovely name indeed. So with that, I think I'm going to bow out. Chichalu, folks.
Hi there, I'm Luba Dvorak, singer-songwriter here in Houston, Texas. You're listening to KPFT Houston.
I'm going blind from the brake lights on this LA freeway tonight.
Hi,
Hi, I'm Mel.
And I'm Ro.
We're from Shame on Me.
And you're listening to KPFT Houston.
Arnie here. Grab a pencil. Your checklist for 5 a.m. Turn off the alarm. Pull the covers over your head. Feed the baby. Clock out of work. Head to the drive-in for coffee and a breakfast burrito. And turn on KPFT. The Attitude with Arnie Arneson is back. Radio that delivers life through the lens of politics and policy. But the operative word is life.
Tune into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, weekday mornings at 5 on KPFT.
Check the back seat. Check the back seat.
All right, come here.
Check the back seat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Pat Byrne. You're listening to Houston's community station, KPFT.
Getting a flu shot helps us stay healthy, so we don't miss out on what matters. Like that family movie night your daughter can't live without.